Okay, committee will come to order. I may have to break in and make another announcement. I'm not sure, Representative Downey. But we do have a quorum present, so we can come to order. And do I have a motion to approve the minutes from February 9th?
So moved, Ms. Chair. So moved.
Okay, Representative Scalzi moves the approval of minutes on February 9th. Do we have any discussion changes? Seeing none, all those in favor of approval of the minutes, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Minutes are approved. We will start out today by taking up House File 192. Representative Beard.
Madam Chair, in order to move the bill before us, I'll move House File 192, recommended pass, and be re-referred to the State Government Finance Committee.
Okay, Representative Beard moves that House File 192 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the State Government Finance Committee. Representative Downey, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And if it would be appropriate, if I could also have the A1 amendment moved so I can get the bill in the form I'd like it for our discussion today.
Madam Chair.
Representative Beard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, to assist the author, I will move the A1 amendment to House File 192.
Okay, Representative Beard moves the A1 amendment.
Madam Chair,
to your amendment.
Perhaps just a brief description of the amendment so folks know how it fits into the bill, the original bill. Three main components. The first is making sure that the language is very specific about restricting the provisions of the bill to just the executive branch agencies of state government, specifically to exclude local units of government, K-12 schools, and the MNSCU system, the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities system. That's the provisions in lines 1 through 14 of the amendment. The second component is the deletion of Article 3, which is the 15% workforce reduction target by the year 2015. That is contained in a separate bill that has passed the State Government Finance Committee and is moving to the Committee on Ways and Means, so we don't need to rehear that bill, which was heard and passed through this committee a couple of weeks ago. And then the final change is the deletion of Article 6, which is the statewide right to work provision, based on a couple of factors. Number one, clearly the intent of this bill is to create a new and more dynamic employment model for state workers, and confusing the broader issue of union engagement throughout the state in the private and public sectors, I think probably distracts attention from the core purpose of the bill. So I would like to strike that article. And very timely, Representative Stensrud has authored a bill allowing some additional pay for performance bonus opportunities to public workers, and so I'm inserting the language from his bill into here where it's a great fit. So with that, Madam Chair, thank you, Representative Beard, for moving my amendment.
Okay, just to clarify, Representative Downey, the Article 3 workforce reduction early retirement is gone under this amendment, as is the right to work language. Is that correct?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Okay. Do we have any other discussion or questions just to the A1 amendment? Okay, all those in favor of the A1 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, please signify by saying nay. The motion does prevail and the A1 amendment is adopted. Please proceed with the substance of your bill, Representative Downey.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. The purpose of this bill is that with the backdrop of unending challenges for state government, fiscal and in terms of our need to try and reinvent and redesign what we do for the 21st century, recognizing that a key component of us achieving those objectives is our workforce, and recognizing that empowering our state workers, giving them new models of state employment that align their own personal incentives and their unit incentives and their agency incentives to the outcomes that we all want from the state, but some new thinking has to occur. And some new models and some new concepts need to be introduced to the public sector employment model. We've been in the existing model for many years, members. I don't think it's well suited to the challenges before us. We're hearing about redesign and reinvention and innovation. Clearly, those are job number one in state and local governments. And I would argue that right now the public sector employment model does not align and incentivize our employees to the extent that it could and should to really make them the force for change, to unlock the potential of our workforce and align it with what we are trying to accomplish in both the executive branch and the legislature this session. So this is all about providing public sector employees some of the same kinds of tools that private sector employees have to align their incentives and to have them be the productive force for change and innovation that I know they can be. Very briefly, a quick description of the articles in the bill. The first is titled Equal Pay and Benefits in the public sector commensurate with the private sector. One of the challenges in public sector is that often there are certain skill sets and job titles for which we are not competitive from a salary and benefits standpoint, and there are some job classifications for which we are paying a premium. And so this provision says that during a period where we would freeze wages at their current levels, no impact on existing contracts, and again remembering that this is just in the executive branch agencies, that we would freeze wages and benefits for the first year of the biennium. And during that time, we would study by position the comparable private sector wage and benefit structures that are appropriate for that kind of a position, and then we would implement that new wage structure for the second year of the upcoming biennium. The second article, it's actually article number 3 in the bill, but the second major provision takes a serious look at the current provision in state law which precludes the state from contracting for any service that could be provided by a state employee and says instead that the state can in fact contract for those services provided that it allows the current bargaining unit performing that service in the state government workforce to competitively bid for that service unencumbered by the overhead and administrative costs that they currently bear in the state complex, and to therefore become value-added service providers and compete for business and bring all of their knowledge and skills to the table and compete with private sector firms for those contracts. The next provision is an employee gain-sharing provision that would allow employees who bring ideas for efficiencies and improvements in service to actually be rewarded with bonuses for doing so, an incentive to actually be part of the creative process. And then lastly, the insertion of the pay-for-performance provision of Representative Stensrud's bill. And if it's all right, members, I'd like to introduce Representative Stensrud and have him describe very briefly the provisions in the pay-for-performance component of the bill.
Welcome to the committee, Representative Stensrud. Please proceed with your discussion of your part of the bill.
All right, thank you. Really, I put together some thoughts on performance-based incentives for the public employees that would really be similar to that in private industry that many people across our state, you know, are able to take part in. And usually, it's based on a couple of different components. So it would be designed by the commissioner, and I think it needs to be worked with in the different divisions and departments. But if it's designed by the commissioner and be tied to three areas, individual goals that are determined with consultation with leadership, but individual goals and your performance towards those goals, and also an evaluation of the performance of the individual in their respective departments or agency that's defined by the agency, and you know, measuring the outcomes of that individual's performance, you know, towards the agency's goals. And then the evaluation also on in a third portion is how is the entire agency doing? So those things combined would equal, you know, the entire amount for that performance. And then those are really the three components, and that's a pretty typical way to evaluate, you know, how a department is doing, how a company is doing based on outcomes or profitability in the private sector, or what kind of great outcomes that are occurring.
So, members, that provision at a 30,000-foot level just says that as state and local governments are moving to try and accomplish outcomes and appropriate for outcomes as compared to inputs, it starts to align the public sector compensation rewards towards those outcomes as well. And so we get an improved alignment there for the work ahead of us. So to summarize, individually and collectively, the components of this bill are intended to empower employees, to improve results, and to align what we're doing in state government ultimately with the realities that are facing us. So implementing this model is going to require a lot of hard work. I hope that today's hearing can begin the process and the dialogue and the collaboration that we need with the executive branch and with representatives of the employees and agency heads. But let's think about this a little bit. Imagine finally being able to reward public employees for the ideas and the effort that they put in, both in terms of new thinking, the intense commitment and effort that they put in on special projects, and I've been a part of a lot of them. These are big, complex initiatives, and people work really hard, and I think we ought to be able to reward them for their participation in that. And imagine an environment where public employees, unencumbered by state overhead, can organize themselves and compete for state contracts. And imagine a scenario where finally we actually have a chance at state government to have a comparable pay and benefit structure with the private sector to attract the talent that we need in certain positions and to not pay a premium in others. We have huge challenges in front of us, not just in the short term with a $6.2 billion budget deficit, but for the long term, creating a sustainable future for the programs that we have in state government and the people that we have in state government. And if we're going to fund priorities and not bureaucracy, if we are going to serve people and not programs, I'm convinced that our people, the employees in state government, have to be not only at the table, but at least in part driving the bus. And this will be a shared leadership role between the legislative branch, the executive branch, and the representatives of the employees. But I'm convinced that not only can we tackle this $6.2 billion budget deficit problem, but we can put our state on a sustainable footing for the future, adjust our cost structure, and serve people even better than we did before. But we won't be able to do it if we don't deal with the current structure of the way we run employment in the state of Minnesota and unlock the full potential of our employees and align their incentives with what we're trying to do as a whole in state government. So with this new approach, I am totally confident that our people can get this done. It's time for us to unshackle them and let them help us get there. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, members. We can take a few questions. I see there are a few amendments that we could address if you'd prefer, or if you'd prefer testimony. Representative Pornstein?
No, I have a question, but if you want to do the testimony first, that's fine.
Either way, if you have a question, maybe I can lay kind of my thought. We do have another bill on the agenda, and we have several people that are on our list to testify, and I'd like to give everybody about 3 minutes and keep on task. My hope is that we could wrap this bill up by about 11:45. That would give us an hour to take testimony and ask questions. If it doesn't work, I'm open to looking at that. So if you'd like to ask a question now, that'd be fine.
Sure. Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, Representative Downey, you just had mentioned towards the end of your presentation, you talked about comparable pay and benefits to the private sector. Well, I mean, there is a private sector that reaped $1.6 billion of taxpayer money for CEO salary increases. And, you know, we have the top CEO in our state making $109 million a year. And so I think there's so much focus on the average, I know AFSCME employee in the state makes $36,000 a year. And so we have so much focus on this when we have, I think, some really outrageous things going on in the private sector in terms of taxpayer-funded bonuses to millionaires. And so I guess I'm interested in your reaction to that piece of what's going on in the private sector and why so much focus on this when I think there's a lot of abuse going, an abuse of taxpayer money through that TARP program and other various Wall Street bailouts. So I'm interested in your thoughts about that.
Representative Downey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Couldn't agree with you more, Representative Hornstein. I don't know why taxpayers are running private enterprises in the first place, and it raises the entire set of questions that you now ask, and why taxpayer funds are going for those kinds of exorbitant compensation levels. I agree, and I think we have a broader societal question to be asked, and I think the accountability lies at the feet of shareholders and boards as to the discrepancy between CEO pay, the highest level of compensation in a company, and the lowest, and the extreme disparity between that. So I'm not sure that I would argue for government intervention in the pure private sector to somehow rectify that, but I do share your concern when the public sector somehow has its fingers in private businesses, why we would allow that to occur. I think the broader question to the bill, however, and that's an interesting side question because my bill doesn't really deal with that, but the intent of the bill is to make sure that we don't end up through whatever mechanisms kind of left us here after a 30-year run of very high growth in state expenditures, then we don't have a situation where there's a perception or a reality of imbalanced pay and benefits in the public sector and the private sector. For the couple of bills that I've carried in this regard, I have tried really, really hard to avoid demagoguery, and there was plenty of demagoguery in the campaign in both directions against people who supposedly weren't willing to pay their fair share, and I've never met a Minnesotan who isn't willing to pay their fair share, and equally on the other side, demagoguing public employees. And so this provision, this equal pay and benefits provision, is specifically designed to cut out all of that and make sure that everybody has confidence, both the employees in state government and taxpayers outside of state government, that we are fairly paying and rightly paying people for the work that they're performing.
Representative Hornstein.
I mean, I'm not sure this is sort of a moderate middle, proposal, but I just, my point is simply that we have so much focus on public employees and what they're making, when we have just, and I'm glad that you agree, and I hope that we can address this. Maybe there's a public policy response in Minnesota to, I think, incredible excess and greed going on in some parts of the private sector. But we seem to sort of shove that aside and have a focus on this, and I think that's very problematic, Madam Chair.
Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. And Representative Downey, good start, and I've worked with you on the Small Business Caucus, and I know we did some good work in that caucus, and there's a lot of legislators who run small businesses, and especially in the new freshman class. I'm just kind of curious, though, when you talk about subcontracting or contracting out services, and you talk about state employees' salaries, et cetera, and how we run our business here being encumbered by state overhead. And contractors, though, subcontractors, also are encumbered by overhead, and because they pay taxes. The state doesn't. So, and I know I've worked a little bit with contractors in the past, and once the state employee is gone, then the state is really dependent on a contractor. But I guess my specific question is, are any of the bill authors currently in the business of contracting or considering beginning a business of contracting with any government agencies? And I don't know if you know of your other bill authors. I guess you would know only yourself specifically, but I would like to know that if possible.
Representative Downey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A direct answer to your question. I can't speak to the other two authors. I'm not aware of them having businesses. As you might know, my previous business, from which I have retired to join the legislature, was an accounting and consulting firm who did quite a lot of work in the public sector, and that's part of what informs a lot of my perspectives on these issues. But to avoid conflict of interest, I have retired from my firm. So nobody in this bill here right now would have, at least as I know, any conflict of interest. And if I could address maybe the bigger backdrop to your question about contracting, I think the natural evolution for organizations is to figure out what their core competencies are and where they really add value. And I think in the public sector, one could argue that it's in the programs and the direct services that we provide that really is what we should be good at and what we need to retain ownership of. And so like any other organization that tries to get better, when there is an outside party that can perform the function for less cost, higher value, better service, I think it makes sense to take a look at that. And we had an occurrence, actually it was in the State Government Finance Committee last year, where there was a $300,000 or $400,000 budget item in the Department of Administration for Resource Recovery. And we were literally in some of our office space having our own people go out and collect recyclable materials, et cetera, when the company from whom we were leasing the space was already doing it. And there are organizations that will even pay you to come in and collect your recycling. And so this is one of the classic cases where, just in a microcosm, you have clearly, I think, an opportunity to contract for something and get a better bang for the buck, not to denigrate the people who are doing the work at the time, but just recognizing that there's an opportunity to get better and to get more efficient and to focus our resources, kind of redeploy those resources, if you will, towards the delivery of the services that have the value, as compared to continuing to think that we have to perform all of those underlying functions in government. So I think contracting is an opportunity. There's an exploitation of it. There's a point where the return doesn't justify the investment, and so I think it's a careful balance. But right now, state law says that if there is somebody in the employ of state government that could do a job, we can't contract for it, and I think we should change that, and as part of changing that, empower our state employees to go out and do that work. A famous example was the city of San Diego, when they chose to contract out for their garbage collection, and the public employees currently providing it were given the opportunity to go off and form their own business, if you will, and compete for the business. And guess what? They won. They're probably doing a great job. So these are the kinds of opportunities that I'm trying to open up.
Well, Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do have a few questions for Representative Downey. I don't have any amendments to offer, and I don't anticipate asking questions of the witnesses, so I hope you'll give a little bit of space.
Certainly.
And I guess, I don't know if we've done this, but, never mind, I'll skip this. First, Representative Downey, your amendment removed Article 6, the right to work constitutional amendment, whose purpose, I take it, is to reduce wages and benefits for everyone in Minnesota. And there's obviously a lot of concern about that, both in this room and more broadly. And I guess I want to make sure that you have, you're going to give us an assurance that this provision is not going to be amended back into this bill after it leaves this committee.
Representative Downey.
Madam Chair, direct answer to your question, it is not my intention to insert the right to work language back into this bill. I believe it is traveling in another bill authored by another representative. So whether or not this is a live ongoing conversation or not, I couldn't tell you. It's not my intention to put it back in here. And members, I just want to encourage us. This happens all the time, and it's an extreme frustration of mine that the rhetoric and the arguments made have absolutely nothing to do with the content of the bill. And the right to work provision, as it was written, was simply designed to allow individual people the freedom to work where they want. And if the union adds value to them and to what's going on at that employer, they have the freedom to join that union, and they have the freedom not to. And so to argue that the intention of the provision or the intention of the author was somehow to drive down wages or whatever the rhetorical statements that we'll hear today and later in the press, just flat out not accurate. Certainly not my intention. The language is originally in the bill because I believe public employees should have that freedom as well, realizing that the scope of the language encompasses so much more than just the executive branch agencies of the public sector, and recognizing that the real intent of this bill is to empower our employees to be engaged with the rest of us in the legislative and the executive branch to be about the tough business of redesigning what we do, deliver services more effectively. I took that provision out. It was, I think, in the end, counterproductive to the ultimate purpose of this bill at this time. So I'm comfortable leaving it out and have no intention of bringing it back.
Madam
Representative Winkler.
Chair, I guess the only response I would give you is that we had a presentation at the One Minnesota Conference at the Humphrey School in which Doug Baker, the CEO of Ecolab, actually addressed one of the big challenges that the Chamber of Commerce sees in doing business in Minnesota, and that is the high cost of labor. And there's one sure way of bringing down the cost of labor, and that would be a right-to-work amendment. But, Madam Chair, if this comes back as an amendment, I assume that this has to come through this committee at some point?
You're talking about the constitutional amendment?
Yes.
It's in rules right now, is my understanding. The Drazkowski bill?
Yes.
And my understanding is it's in rules.
Madam Chair, I guess my point would be that I think that amendment does affect state government and local government operations extensively, so I would assume that it would have to come back here before it could ever be.
Representative Winkler, I have not taken a look at the bill, but I will certainly take that under consideration and discuss it with you beforehand.
Okay, thank you. Representative Downey, Madam Chair, Representative Downey, you also have this compensation study in Article 2. One study to be done by March 2012 to try to compare public and private workers, some of which, and I think you'll acknowledge this, are very difficult to compare. How do you compare the salary of a state trooper to somebody in the private sector? Probably you're not going to use the Southdale mall cops as a comparison or something. But the concern I have, and I think you'll acknowledge that there are some things that don't match up quite right, but we can probably do some good work. But the concern I have is that you're doing this at one point in time. You're doing it as of March 1st, 2012, and you don't have any provision for an ongoing study. It occurs to me that two things could happen. First, we're coming through the worst recession in 60 years, more, and 70 years, and wages and benefits in the private sector have just been pushed way down. And if we are pegging public employee compensation to the private sector right now, we're doing it at a low point, and yet you don't have any provision in this bill for public sector employment to increase as private sector employment, wages and benefits increases as we come out of the recession. So are you open to amending this bill so that we have ongoing, say, every 2 years you have a compensation study, and as we get big increases in private sector wages and benefits, those will be also captured by public employees?
Representative Downey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Winkler, actually, you raise a really good point, and yes, I would be. I think absent the other articles in the bill, that gets extremely problematic. For example, if the state doesn't have an opportunity to contract out and let the private sector kind of compete for various functions of what we do, I'm not sure that works real well, but I think that's an amendment you and I could work on to make sure that it's a continuing study. I think that's a good idea. And members of the committee, I don't know in your occupations the kinds of wage studies that you've seen, but in my business, every year when we reset our employee compensation, we got exhaustive studies that were not only regional in nature around the country, but regional in nature relative to the markets that people were working in. And so these kinds of benchmark studies exist out in the marketplace. And so I don't think we're talking about some kind of an arbitrary and capricious comparison of a state parole or a corrections officer with an accounts payable person at a big business. But there is a huge swath of what we do in the public sector where there is a direct comparison. And for those positions where there's not a direct comparison, we can do regional market studies against other states to actually compare where we're at and come up with what I think is a fair compensation structure.
Well, Madam
Representative Winkler.
Representative Downey, another thing that could happen potentially, and I know you'd be shocked by this, but what if the study comes back and it turns out that public employees are making less than private employees in comparable positions? How are we going to pay for that automatic increase that this bill would provide? What if your assumption is not proven accurate?
Representative Downey.
Madam Chair and Representative Winkler. Actually, I'm not sure where you got the fact that I'm not thinking about that. It was in my opening comments that there are many positions in state government right now where we're not competitive with the labor market. We addressed some of that in the information technology space some years ago. But clearly, when you look at the enterprise and the technical nature of some of these positions, I fully expect that compensation for some positions would go up. And this isn't about, and again, let's get past the rhetoric and get to the intention of the bill. This is about equal pay and benefits for the private sector versus the public sector.
But
it's not, well,
sorry, I thought you were done.
This is not about some kind of attack on public employees. This is about getting beyond the demagoguery, Representative Winkler, and actually coming to a fair compensation structure for fair work in the public sector as compared to what everybody else is experiencing.
Representative Winkler, would you, Representative Simon needs to leave and he wanted to ask a question. Would you mind holding off for just a second to allow Representative Simon to ask his question? Representative
Thank you,
Simon.
Madam Chair and Representative Winkler, I just have to step out to meet some folks, but I just wanted to get on the record, Representative Downey, that I know something we discussed in the previous committee that I think is important to point out. We just yesterday in the State Government Finance Committee, as you know because you serve on the committee, we got the state workforce report for 2010, and I think it's important to get on the record the fact that according to the latest figures, in Minnesota we now have fewer public employees on the payroll than we did 10 years ago. And yet, I think everyone in this room would acknowledge we've asked them to do more with less, and because of the recession, there's more pressure on them. There are more people that are seeking government services of almost all kinds. I note on page 28 of the report, which we don't have in front of us, obviously, but I'll read from it. It says that in terms of the net amounts that we're spending on employees over the last several years, that any increase, and they are modest increases, stem either from collectively bargained small, very small increases in salary, and increased health care costs, which is beyond the control of any particular state employee, and then finally legislatively mandated increases in employer and employee retirement contributions from fiscal years 2007 to 2010. And then the narrative section says, please note that the increase in overall compensation has significantly dropped from fiscal years 2009 to 2010 compared to previous years. And that's because there have been no general salary increases and no step progression increases given to employees in fiscal year 10. So I just want to put this in perspective. There's been a lot of talk, not yet today so far, and not on your bill here today so far, about government out of control or bloated or unsustainable. But it would give me great comfort, and I think the committee, to hear from you that you acknowledge, though this is one potential tool of yours for what you see as a reform agenda, will you acknowledge that the rate of state employee hiring and the rate of state employees that we have is really not part of the problem? If the problem is the size of government, the number of state employees and their salary and their benefits is not the problem. Do you acknowledge that?
Representative Downey.
Madam Chair, a couple of points of clarification on page 28 of the workforce report, and people don't have this. I don't think it was a handout here in this committee. But from 2006 to 2007, total compensation in the executive branch agencies, which is the focus of this bill, increased 4.1%. 2007 to 2008, it increased 7.28%. 2008 to 2009, it increased 4.84%. And 2009 to 2010, it increased 1.03%. So that's an aggregation of wages and compensation and total benefits. And I want to be careful because everything that you're hearing rhetorically about the bill, frankly, has very little to do with the bill and more about making broader points. And I appreciate the tactic being employed. I think the fair statement is to say that in the last 3 years, public sector employment in the executive branch agencies has actually increased 350 positions. And if you want to lay in MNSCU and look at local governments where they've actually started working on reductions and restructuring their workforce to adapt to the new realities, you can come up with an aggregate picture that says, yeah, indeed, we have basically been flat. But in the last 3 years, when private sector industry has been decimated and productivity gains have now caught up with that decimation to the point where the private sector is again profitable, that's not a statement of a problem as though it somehow lies with our people. That is the identification of a huge opportunity in the public sector, one that we have not even started to take on. And I mentioned on the floor yesterday a report, 1995, Live Within Our, or Within Our Means was the title of the report from Minnesota Planning. And it recognized that we had been on a 10-year spending curve that exceeded any projection of future revenues, and it actually predicted the year 2010 as the year where the demographic realities of our state were going to make it literally unsustainable to continue perpetuating the programs and the design of state government at that point in time. And so here we sit in 2010, dozens of reform and redesign proposals that went on the shelf as soon as the federal stimulus money became apparent to the legislature 2 years ago, and now our backs are against the wall. And we aren't going to get there. We aren't going to redesign these programs. We aren't going to serve the people of Minnesota the way we can if we don't engage and empower the people that we employ. And every single one of these provisions is about opportunity. The opportunity for them to participate in a meaningful way in redesigning what we're doing, the opportunity for them to realize some financial benefit from doing it, just like any other employee might get a bonus from doing it. So I really want to discourage us from engaging in some kind of broader demagogic debate, rhetorical political debate, and let's focus on the provisions of the bill that do just that. This is about empowering our employees to be part of a solution that we have to get to. And if we don't, if we continue to lock ourselves into a cost structure and an employment model structure, eventually we do hit a brick wall. And I'm not going to recount examples of places where that has happened and the decimation that's occurred to employees and their families and their kids' lives when you hit the brick wall as hard as we might. So it's time to get about the serious business of reforming what we're doing, finding better ways to serve people, and engaging our employees in that process. And I think this bill is a really great first step to doing that.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Downey, I know that that is your intention, and that you're trying to look for new models and new ways of doing things, and I appreciate that. And I've seen that 1995 report by Minnesota Planning, but I guess your response troubles me in the sense that you're right, it talked about the sustainability of government spending, but I don't remember anything in that report talking about how the problem, or I'll turn it around, that the solution to that was to freeze wages of state employees or to somehow rework the way that state government was organized with respect to how many employees we have. I will praise what you have in the bill in terms of employee gain sharing and empowering employees. My experience has been that the ones who know where to find the savings are the ones on the ground in the agencies, in state governments. They're the ones who really know where you can find efficiencies and savings, and I think it's a very positive part of your bill that you have employee gain sharing and other similar provisions in there. I just feel the need, though, to repeat, because I think there is a public perception that often doesn't match up with the facts. I'm looking at the workforce report right here. In 2001, on a calendar year count, we had 33,251 employees. In 2010, we had 33,090 employees. Some might say you shouldn't do it on a calendar year count because some of these are seasonal workers. So if you go to the fiscal year count, which is a July 1 count, not a January 1 count, in 2001, we had 34,596 employees. And today we have 34,123 employees. That's over a decade span in the history of the state where there have been added pressures and burdens and responsibilities placed on state government. I just think we have to put it in perspective. I'm not saying some of the things in this bill aren't worth doing, and I applaud you for taking the considerable time you've taken to figure out how to do things differently. What I'm saying is we ought to just slow down and just put this problem in perspective. I don't think you can get any more stable and sustainable than flat. And that's what we've seen is sustainable, flat growth, or no growth, slight decreases in the state workforce. So I just want to make that point very clear. Thank you.
Representative Downey?
Madam Chair, I...
Please. We're not going to have clapping or booing or any of the like in here. It'll take too long. Representative Downey?
Well, Madam Chair, first of all, I'll repeat my call. Not to mischaracterize the bill, nor my intentions, nor any statement that I might ever have made. Representative Simon repeated his assertion that we are blaming employees for some kind of problem. I couldn't disagree more. This bill is about empowering the employees, many of whom are sitting in this room, to engage with us on the tough work ahead. And you can selectively pull all the statistics you want, Representative Simon, you happen to choose from the apportionment count section of our workforce, not the full-time equivalent count. And the full-time equivalent count has gone up 350 people over the last 3 years. And so that is pretty stable. But stable in state government is not sustainable. The status quo of the spending that we have in front of us, both at the program and at the operational level, does not align with our revenues. And you can talk about raising revenues through some tax increases this two-year period, but guess what? When spending continues to grow faster than revenues, what are we going to do 2 years from now? The same thing. We'll have the same debate. We've been having the same debate for 15 years, and it's time for this legislature to own up to that, partner with the governor, and find a way to get through it, and we're not going to get there without our people. And those of you who have been through big organizational changes and process redesign know that it's people, process, and technology all moving in the same direction at the same time. And to think that we can address our fundamental operational and program design changes without engaging all three legs of that stool is misguided and will end up at a point of failure. So I want to get back to the focus of this bill, which is giving our employees the tools to participate in that with us.
Thank you. Okay. And I interrupted Representative Winkler. If all members could just bear in mind to ask questions directly related to the bill and not sort of a broad picture, because the bill at hand is 192. So please proceed, Representative Winkler.
Well, Madam Chair, it's important that we bear in mind that the justification stated for the bill by Representative Downey was government spending, increased government spending over time. And the method that he has for addressing government spending is to reduce the salaries and benefits of the workforce. And yet we know from the workforce report and from extensive hearings we've had in this committee and in the State Government Finance Committee that employees, state employees, are not driving the increases in government spending. You know very well, Representative Downey, that if you want to address state government spending, you have to address K-12 education, you have to address property taxes, and you have to address health and human services, nursing homes and hospitals. So this is why we keep coming back to the rhetorical point, because you state that spending is the problem, and yet your solution is to target employees, which are not the problem. As Representative Simon has pointed out, their employment has been flat. In the last of the last five biennia, in good times and bad, three out of the five times the increases have been less than inflation. So this isn't public employees driving government out of control. And I'd like to get back to something specific in the bill, where I was going before, which is, what if, in an aggregate level, public employees, when you add them all up, should be making more in comparison to the private sector than they are? Wouldn't that just create a additional financial burden? Or, since we only appropriate so much and they have to get paid so much more, the only alternative would be layoffs. Why? It seems to me that what you're doing is just drawing an artificial date and then saying everything else should adjust around that. And you're not really getting into the careful work that should be required before we start messing around with collective bargaining agreements.
Representative Downey.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Winkler. And I appreciate your transition from rhetoric to an actual question about the bill. Frankly, I could live with an outcome of the wage study that produces a net increase in public sector employment. I think almost all of the data out there that compares public to private sector would indicate that there's probably a good chance of fairly significant net savings. And I see you shaking your head, but the studies that would seem to indicate otherwise compare people in the public sector based on their years' experience and their educational attainment to people of similar years' experience and educational attainment in the private sector, and do not consider at all the job function that's being performed. And so my bill does not prescribe an age and educational attainment comparison with the private sector, but a job function to job function comparison. Well, so that a police officer gets compared fairly to whatever the comparison is, an accounts payable processor gets compared fairly, database administrator gets compared favorably, and we'll let the chips fall where they may. This is about equal pay and benefits, not about attacking people.
Well, Madam Chair, my final point.
Representative Winkler.
Representative Downey, you know very well that state workers are better educated and they tend to be older than the private sector. We have this bubble moving through. So if you don't want to consider education, and if you don't want to consider years of experience, which, by the way, I think that's what we're supposed to be telling our employees we want them to do, which is to get better trained, get better educated, and devote their careers to public service. But if you don't want to consider those things, and you know very well that they tend to be older and they tend to be better educated, then you're prescribing an outcome that you want. You don't want to do a fair study. What you're prescribing is an absolute necessary conclusion that their wages and benefits have to come down.
Madam Chair.
Representative Downey.
Representative Winkler, thank you, because I think you have made the point of this article extremely well, and that is, if you have somebody who is posting accounts receivable checks into an accounting system in the public sector, and you have that same person doing the exact same work in the private sector, and the person in the public sector, because they have X number of years experience and educational attainment, is somewhere on some kind of salary scale, I would argue that the value that we are receiving in the public sector has an opportunity for improvement. Maybe that's an area that we consider contracting for. Maybe that's an area where the net compensation level actually comes down in the public sector. So that's the kind of comparison that I want, and I think it's a fair comparison, and I guarantee you there will be a lot of positions that go up, especially in the highly technical, specialized skill areas. And I can tell you there's some people sitting in this room that I work closely with on our staff here in the House that darn sure ought to be making more money based on the competency and the skill and the knowledge that they have of our legal environment and our statutory environment here. So I'm fully prepared to live with the outcomes of that study.
Okay. Representative Winkler, if you have more questions, we'll put you at the bottom of the list, if that's all right. Representative Beard.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I enjoy serving with Representative Winkler because he always makes me think and makes me want to engage in philosophical discussions. And if you'll indulge me, I have just one thought I'd like to challenge his thinking and make us think about a little more. And then I got a question or perhaps a segue for the author of the bill. Representative mentioned a few moments ago that the surest way to lower our standard of living was to pass the amount. I think he was referring to Article 6 or 8 in the bill, which has been withdrawn at the moment. I would submit that that's an incomplete understanding of the laws of economics, members. There are several ways to drive down our standard of living that we enjoy in this state, and that is one that is debatable. The surest way, in my understanding of economics, is to drive up our costs or allow our costs to remain high while others are adjusting their costs and become more competitive. That, I think, is the surest way to make sure we have a slow decline when companies that are looking to locate here, and I hold out the dialysis unit at Medtronic, I've mentioned it before, when it came to locating a facility with 7,000 employees in a brand new product, Minnesota wasn't even asked to compete for the new headquarters of that division. We weren't even asked to compete, members. Three other states were, and it eventually landed in San Antonio, I believe, in Texas for sure. So here we are. We lost 77,000 jobs, averaging over $50,000 a year. And I have to ask, I say that just to illustrate the point, that there are more than one way to assure that we are maintain a long, slow slide, and we lose quality of life. And a lot of it is to keep our costs high. That's the other side of the economic coin. We can artificially keep wages high, or we can allow ourselves to compete. And this is my second point. And this gets, I think, to some of the thrust of the bill.
Representative Beard, I really would like to limit the rhetoric on both sides, but if you could get to a question, that would be great.
This is actually basic understanding of what we're dealing with here today, I would contend, Madam Chair. It's not about wages, members. It's about productivity. It's about value. And it's about the ability of us as government and the things we can control here to allow our employees to help us do the job better, which gets, I think, to Articles 2 and 4 of the bill, where we deal with the gain sharing and the value-added compensation and, of course, now that I'm looking for it, cost-effective provision of services. Members, we can afford to pay high wages if we can maintain our productivity increases, and that's a very important part of the bill that's getting lost, I think, here in some of the other things we're talking about that are important for us to make for political purposes, and I don't disparage that. This is a political place. But when it comes to laws of economics, I just wanted to throw that out for our consideration, and Representative, I just want to applaud you for including parts of your bill that actually recognize the productivity increases and for designing some sort of a method where we can actually share those with our employees.
Thank you. I don't think there's a question there. Thank you for your thoughts on that. Balance out the discussion a little bit. Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'll just start right out by saying I don't have a question here. Purely comment.
Okay, if you can, if
and
you
I'll
can
keep
make it short
too.
You can make it short, Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Downey. First of all, I would just like to give you credit for designing a bill and certainly things that you believed in there, including the right to work. But recognizing the concerns of many people and taking those provisions that were onerous to many people, including I'm sure many in this room, out of the bill and making it more acceptable, and recognizing also the needs for redesign and for doing things differently, because like it or not, as we go into the future, if we don't change, we're not going to be successful as a state. And to keep this state great, I think we do need to recognize these areas of redesign and doing things differently. So I do give you credit for that. And this may not be the perfect bill yet, but hopefully through the process we'll come up with something that works well.
Thank you. If it's okay with members, we have one more member question on the list, and then I would like to get to testimony. I would hate to have to see these folks who have probably taken the day off work to have to come back another day. So, Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. And Representative Downey, maybe you can answer this or somebody else that you have with you. But looking at the employment the state employee numbers from the year 2001 to 2010 as actually being lower, I'm just kind of curious. I don't know the answer to this. How has the population changed from 2001 to 2010 so that I can kind of get a correlation for these figures?
Representative Downey.
Madam Chair, I don't have those statistics. I'd be remiss to try and give you an answer off of recollection. I think we could get that from the state demographer.
Okay, at this time, I'd like to move into the public testimony. We do have a lengthy list of testifiers. I'd like to start that. Those of you testifying, we're trying to limit it to 3 minutes. We do have some cards here to keep us on task a little bit. Shar Knutson first, and then we'll move on to Jerry Hansen and Linda Hamilton after that. Good morning. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much. Good morning to all of you, Madam Chair, committee representatives. My name is Shar Knutson, and I'm president of the Minnesota AFL-CIO, which is a labor federation with more than 1,000 local within unions who represent well over 300,000 working men and women in this state. And for us, one of our top priorities is to ensure that all Minnesotans who want to work are working in jobs that can support either themselves or themselves in a family. First, I'd like to thank you today for amending this bill to remove the constitutional amendment. Because nonpartisan studies show that all workers in right-to-work states, whether they are union members or not, earn on an average $5,000 less each year than workers in Minnesota. And I'm sure you would agree with me that we shouldn't ever be asking middle-class families to work for less. And especially not in these challenging economic times. As you see from the turnout today and the emails that you've likely been receiving, Minnesota's unions families will be opposed to right to work, the so-called right to work, in any way, shape, or form. Now, that being said, the Minnesota AFL-CIO and all these people here, most of these people here, strongly oppose House File 192 in its amended form. And there will be a number of speakers, and I think they will touch on a number of reasons. But I would like to say that restricting what an employee and an employer can bargain over is an infringement on the right to bargain in good faith. This bill mandates a pay freeze for all state workers, no matter who they are, whether they're a snowplow driver or a nurse. That means the pay rates cannot be negotiated during the bargaining. That's bad. However, there's really a deeper concern that we also see, too, about this bill. This bill, and others like it, demands that hardworking, middle-class Minnesotans will once again bear the burden of the state's revenue shortfall. Now, over the last decade, we've seen cuts and more cuts, and they have resulted in higher property taxes, higher college tuition, and fewer vital services at a time when more and more people are needing those services. So I ask you, when do we all share the burden of this? And when are we going to ask everyone to help with relieving this? When are we going to ask the more fortunate among us to sacrifice as we have been sacrificing? So I ask you to respectfully vote this bill down, because Minnesotans, middle-class Minnesotans, have already sacrificed more than their fair share. Thank you.
Thank you. Next on the list is Jerry Hansen. And again, all members, when you testify, if you could please state your name and what group you're representing, that will make things run smoother. Jerry Hansen, Linda Hamilton, and then Josiah Hill. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, committee members, thank you for this opportunity to speak with you today. My name is Jerry Hansen. I work for the City of St. Paul as a mechanical inspector, and I'm a rank-and-file member of Pipefitters Local 455. I offer this information as background only. I'm only representing myself. I'm not a spokesperson representative of the union, or certainly not the City of St. Paul. I took some time off today to speak to you about House File 192. Now, I understand you amended out the Constitution Amendment would make Minnesota a so-called right-to-work state, and I'm glad you did. Right-to-work, I think, is a bad idea for Minnesota. I feel it's an intrusion by the government in the free bargaining process between employees and their employer. Politicians on both sides are talking about creating jobs. Right-to-work, or what I prefer to call the right-to-work-for-less laws, will not create good jobs we need. They'll lower wages, leaving workers with less money to spend. This will further weaken our state's economy. In fact, the average worker in this state, as Ms. Knutson stated, is making $5,500 less. And who can afford a $5,500 a year cut in pay? After all, when everything's said and done, consumer spending is what drives our economy. These laws are also a threat to safety on the job site. These laws weaken unions so we can't bargain for safe, healthy working conditions, resulting in more injuries and even deaths at the work site. Statistics from the United States Department of Labor show, for example, that in 2003, the rate of workplace fatalities per 100,000 were higher in right-to-work states. While I'm glad you removed right-to-work from this bill, I understand that there are others floating around the Capitol right now. I urge you and your fellow legislators to make sure these bills don't pass. Minnesota faces challenges right now, and attacking hardworking people will certainly not serve the needs of our state. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you. And members, going forward, if you could refrain from talking about portions of the bill that have been removed, that would include Article 3, the workforce reduction, and Article 6, the right-to-work constitutional amendment. That will be appreciated. We don't usually testify to things that aren't actually in a bill. So if you could limit comments to what remains in the bill, that would be greatly appreciated. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee representatives. My name is Linda Hamilton. I'm a registered nurse practicing at the bedside at Children's Hospitals and Clinics in Minneapolis. But I'm here today as president of the Minnesota Nurses Association, representing 20,000 nurses in Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Iowa. We are pleased that you have deleted the right to work language in the House File 192 and the section that would have prohibited us from negotiating contracts for our public employees, including those at Hennepin County Medical Center. However, for the record, we do want to state our opposition to the so-called right-to-work language and any provisions which interfere our right to collectively bargain on behalf of our members. These measures fundamentally obstruct our right to speak out on behalf of our patients. We remain concerned that House File 192 interferes with our collective bargaining rights and imposes a wage freeze on our state nurses. The 700 M&A nurses in the state of Minnesota contract have already woefully underpaid and understaffed. and in some of the most compromising environments imaginable. These nurses provide critical and compassionate care to our veterans, the elderly, those suffering from mental illness, the disabled, and the incarcerated. Until the 1990s, the state registered nurses received pay and benefits that were comparable to the private market. Since that time, wage and benefits have fallen dramatically behind. So nurses working in state service receive an average of $13 less an hour. The ability of our nurses to deliver care in these settings is at a crossroads. The bill does not recognize the quiet toll already imposed on our nurses by the wholesale slashing of funding in previous rounds of cuts. These measures will only serve to create an even more dangerous condition for patients and nurses. House File 192 is bad for nurses, it's bad for patients, and we urge you to oppose the measures in this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. And again, this is televised. I want anybody watching to fully understand that Article 6, the right to work, constitutional amendment, is not in the bill. So if your testimony is to right to work, I would prefer not to take it now. That is not part of this bill, and it's not necessary to talk about general philosophy. Having said that, we'll move on to Josiah Hill. We'll go on to Jan Elsweger and then Kate Lynch. Oh, Josiah not here? Oh, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Thanks again for the opportunity to testify this morning during your ongoing discussion of House File 192. My name is Josiah Hill, and I'm proud and privileged to serve as a high school teacher of students in the English department at Stillwater Area High School. I also have the honor, a new honor this year, of serving as our local president of the St. Croix Education Association. This new role has taken me to unbelievable places and allowed me to see some amazing things. Just in the past few months, I've been able to watch teachers at high school level bring excitement to students working on a set of calculus problems. A teacher navigate a group of 25 kindergartners through a lockdown drill for the first time. We've also seen our special education teachers working hard each day in collaboration with their partners at the schools to help our students learn. And that's the bottom line. I want to continue by saying that we're in a critical moment here in the history of this great state. I have the honor and great responsibility to stand before students each day in the classroom. My colleagues are also in gyms, labs, and rehearsal spaces. We have challenges. Everybody in this room has challenges. We understand that. But I feel like House File 192 is bad for Minnesota, and specifically bad for our working families. I want to point out that it's not our climate, and I know this because I walked across the street this morning. It's not our climate that brought more Fortune 500 companies to this state than any other per capita. It's the fertile workforce that we have here in Minnesota. I want to further point out that I support the recent amendments that I heard here this morning. For the wage freeze amendment, article, and also for the right to work article. But I want to point out that there are other parts of this bill that continue to damage and lay a heavy burden on our working families. I want to point out one other thing. You don't hear this very often. You don't hear it enough. I'm proud to be a union member. I'm very proud to be a union member. All four of my grandparents are union members.
Please, no clapping or booing.
All four of my grandparents are union members. They're a part of what we refer to as the greatest generation. I spoke to them on the phone last night to tell them what I was going to do today, and they told me how proud they were. That means a lot. But I also need to move on and say there are union families out there, and there are working families out there that are going to be hurt badly by this bill. I want to finish up by saying we've already been burdened by the problems that this state has in a financial sense. Last year, teachers in the state of Minnesota, and these are numbers from the Minnesota Department of Education, on average got a raise of 17 whopping dollars. As we move forward, I want to point out one last time that House File 192 is wrong for Minnesota at this time. This is precisely the right time to invest in our future and precisely the right time to invest in our working class families. I'll finish by saying this. A close friend of mine who works for a Fortune 500 company here in Minnesota told me, "I'm out of touch. I don't get it. I'm a union member." He said, "Look, my company will bounce. We'll go over to South Dakota. We'll go somewhere else." And I said, "Well, That's their choice. You may have to send me a postcard or a prairie dog or something. He said, I'm not going. I would never raise my family in some of these other places that we talked about. He said, I want to be right here in the great state of Minnesota. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. I did want to point out, too, to testifiers that not only does this not address the right to work constitutional amendment, I want to point out that this bill does not affect teachers, nurses, pipe fitters, etc. It only affects legislative and executive branch employees as amended.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Jan Allswiger, Education Minnesota. I did want to go on record as supporting the A1 amendment and have brief comments supporting the A1 amendment related to the wage freeze and the right to work. However, we do have concerns about the remainder pieces of the language, and we do have concerns about the bill as a whole. We support passing the A1 amendment because this is a local control issue. We don't believe the state should be making these decisions. And I'm just going to give you some facts and figures and conclude with that. In Minnesota, our average teachers are not making that much. I started lobbying 16 years ago, and I believe at that time, Minnesota teachers were ranked number 8 in the country in terms of average salary. Now, in 2005, we were at 16. We're 16th. 2009, we're lowered to the 20th spot in the nation. But you might say, well, that's still above average. It really isn't, because when you look at the dollar amount of the average salary, we are $2,000 less than the average teacher salary in the country. Teacher salaries are not not part of the problem in the budget. In 2000, the teacher's salaries as a percentage of the Minnesota state budget was 40.3%. We are now at 38.8%. Teachers in rural Minnesota, some of them barely make $50,000 after 25 years or more of teaching. And then if you look at the health insurance increases that these teachers have been seeing, many teachers are taking home less year after year after year. So we support the A1 amendment and that it does take the wage freeze out for school employees, but we cannot support the bill in its entirety, even without the amendments. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll have Kate Lynch, Brian Rice, and John Delmonico, and if everybody could keep the testimony strictly to what is in the bill as amended, that would be greatly appreciated. Sir, Kate Lynch, are you here?
I'm with SEIU Healthcare Minnesota. Kate Lynch is here, but in view of your earlier admonition, we'll take a pass.
Thank you. Brian Rice.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Brian Rice. I'm here representing the Minnesota Professional Firefighters, and I'll also offer testimony on behalf of John Delmonico from the Police Officers Federation of Minneapolis. And to the bill, there are three sections in the bill as amended that I think this committee on a policy level should have a grave, grave concerns. Specifically on page 2, line 27 through 32 as amended. And specifically, I'll read this statement because this really goes to the guts of the bill as it affects public safety, law enforcement. Representative Downey's bill now says that executive branch employees may not legally strike due to an employer's action, and it goes on to say neither an employer nor an exclusive representative may request interest arbitration regarding any element of compensation prescribed by this section, and an arbitrator may not issue an award that would conflict with this section. In effect, Representative Downey's bill repeals PELRA for public sector labor employees on a statewide level, and I assume if the state's going to set this precedent for its employees, it's just a very small step, Representative Downey, for you to do this for every public employee in the state. So make no mistake, this bill repeals PELRA. And I think the committee, before it does that, 40 years ago this legislature enacted PELRA because there was great unrest in the public sector. And I've been a lawyer since 1982. I've lobbied at the legislature since 29. I've represented public employee groups at collective bargaining tables since 1984. Everything that I've known on both sides, the Pelra Law was a model for harmonious relationships between the government and public sector unions, and Representative Downey's bill throws that out. You're throwing out 40 years of history of collective bargaining in this on that section. So to say this is not significant, I heard the other parts about reform and incentivizing employees to do things, but this totally takes it away. I mean, unions that have been formed over decades. Charlie Stenvig, who's a figure you may or may not know, was the mayor of Minneapolis. He led the Police Federation of Minneapolis, the job that John DeMonico now has. He led a job action because the employment relationship in Minneapolis was so bad, he almost took the cops out on strike. If you set this precedent today for state employees, you're going to be asked to do it again for local government employees. And to the amendment, there are two sections in the amendment, page 2, line 2.12 to 2.15, basically says, again, you're repealing collective bargaining. It says an employee in the executive branch, I'm looking at 2.21 on Amendment A1, an employee in the executive branch may not receive an increase in salary or wages based on cost of living or progression to another step or lane unless the employee's supervisor certifies that the employee's individual performance has been satisfactory and justifies spending additional public funds on the employee's compensation. That was the reason we had collective bargaining in the first place. The autocracy, arbitrariness of supervisors and how they treat employees. I mean, that one sentence is just, that was the basis of the whole purpose. And you're throwing this out with this amendment, Representative Downey, into the bill. And my last point on the bill, specifically the policy that set the amendment A1, 2.23, during the biennium, it says that under the performance bonus component, at least 5% of the total base salary and wages otherwise payable to an employee may be paid only after the completion of performance appraisal conducted under Minnesota Statutes 43A20, paragraph A, which is the study Representative Downey wants to compare jobs, upon the appointing authority's determination that the employee's performance has been satisfactory and justifies spending additional public funds. I read that to mean it's an automatic 5% pay cut to any employee out there now, because it's going to take a while to get this study done, and you can't, this provision says you can't pay 5% of compensation until the study's done. Mm-hmm. And my very last point, I know I've been told to stop, is this. There was a study done by the Chamber of Commerce. They looked at the sum of about 290,000 public employee jobs in the entire state, state and local. They came up with some comparisons, and the truth is you're comparing apples to oranges. There's a representative, let's get a cop and let a cop and we'll have the security guard to the Mall of America. The state legislature has authorized police officers to kill people. They have the use of deadly force. It's a very unique authority. They are authorized to do this. You don't authorize security guards at the Mall of America to kill people. You require cops to retain educational degrees. You require them to pass tests. You put a number of other things on them. And to say that you're somehow going to find a comparison there, I just say good luck with that one. Thank you.
Thank you. John Delmonico, you can work your way up.
He won't be here.
John, don't, okay. I will have Russ Stanton come up and Mike Buzzing. And I did want to make a clarification. Some nurses are affected, apparently those who work for DHS, Department of Health and Corrections, because they fall under the executive branch. So we'll make that clarification. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Russ Stanton. I'm Director of Government Relations for the Interfaculty Organization, which is the union of the faculty at the seven state universities. In the interest of time, I'll focus just on Article 5. The IFO opposes Article 5. If I read Article 5 correctly, it authorizes each agency to determine whether or not to contract out services currently performed by state employees, and then state employees would get the right to bid, form groups and bid to do the work they're currently doing. Let me just give you a scenario of what raises concerns for our faculty. Last month, I just got back from India. I was there for a while because my wife is teaching on a Fulbright there. And all over the suburb that the Delhi airport is located in, there's just one office tower after another going up for call centers. India has more advanced degrees than the United States, teaching degrees. Most of those people speak English, and they work for very, very low wages. If our faculty were to have to bid against those folks, quite frankly, they would lose. The jobs would go to India. That would be very good for India's economy, not so good for the quality of teaching in Minnesota or the economy of Minnesota. I know there's some people that don't really care about unions, but for those who do care, you should realize that this would also destroy union contracts because you can't have individual groups going off cutting their own deals and try to enforce any kind of a contract. I happen to be a member of the legislature, the House, back in 1973 when they passed PELRA. I've watched it grow over the last four decades. It works really well. And we shouldn't be undermining it. Unions have been very effective and efficient. The IFO, for instance, delivers higher education on a per pupil cost that's among the lowest in the nation, and it's constantly dropping. The state unions have formed a coalition, as part of their coalition, have negotiated health care cost containment measures, which have held premiums constant now for 2 years and saved the employer millions upon millions of dollars in employer premiums. They have made sacrifices. I know my union negotiated a 0-0 in light of the budget contract, budget crisis. We shouldn't use the current budget crisis to undermine our public employee unions. They did not cause the problem, and we should be working together to solve it. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Next on the list is Mike Oosing, and then Stephen Law. And the last witness we will have is Matt Hodup. Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm Mike Oosing. I'm president of the AFSCME Council 5. AFSCME Council 5 is a union of 43,000 workers who advocate for excellence in public services, dignity in the workplace, and opportunity and prosperity for all working families. I do want to thank the committee for removing the constitutional amendment. But even though that constitutional amendment has been removed, AFSCME Council 5 is still opposed to House File 192. The Public Employee Labor Relations Act, or PELRA, establishes the rules for collective bargaining between Minnesota's public employers and representatives of public employees. PELRA grants public employees the right to unionize and bargain collectively, sets the criteria for establishment of bargaining units, provides for election of exclusive representatives, and contains procedures for resolving impasses in bargaining. The bill before you supersedes and interferes with this process. The bill is also presumptuous to assume, it is also presumptuous to assume that through this bill, you have the answer to the state's budget problem. The bill before you assumes that compensation for public employees is the cause of the state's deficit. In fact, if former Governor Pawlenty had fired all state employees, the cost savings would have erased only 21% of the state's current $6.2 billion budget deficit. As the committee heard earlier, Minnesota state's workforce is the 10th leanest and one of the most productive in the nation. Minnesota has 71 public employees for every 10,000 residents, according to the U.S. Census. We're tied with a somewhat conservative Florida and we are working harder with fewer co-workers. Since 2002, Governor Pawlenty cut 11% of the state's public workforce. As a result, AFSCME lost 1,590 members. We cannot continue to force workers out of their homes through increased property taxes, locked libraries, shut down parks and rec centers, lose police and fire protection, or restrict students from attaining higher education because the tuition is unaffordable, and cut programs that protect children, the elderly, and the disabled. So I ask you to please vote no on this bill and others like it. Please protect the rights of workers and stop trying to balance the budget on the backs of workers, whether public or private. And I thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you for coming. Is there Stephen Law here? Okay, then we will move on to our last public testimony, Matt Hodup. Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Matt Hodap. I'm the president of the Minnesota State Troopers Association. I'm also here representing MLEA, which is the bargain unit number one, all of the licensed law enforcement in the state of state employees, BCA, game wardens, and the like. My concern with the bill, and I've had some brief discussions with the author, are in reference to Article 2 of the bill, wherein it appears that the provisions of PELRA, as well as the pay freezes and whatnot for state employees under the executive branch, which as a state trooper, that's where I would fall under, that we would not have the ability to collectively bargain, at least during the time of this study. Concern that I have is one of, in law enforcement, I don't believe there's any like position out there in the private sector that would compare to law enforcement. And so the author has agreed to at least look at some possibilities of looking at those state jobs that we have that have no comparable position in the private sector. But this concern of this bill and others like it when it comes to public employee rhetoric or bashing or whatever it is, that is a concern of mine, and thank you for your time, Madam Chair.
Thank you so much. Thank you, everyone who took time from their busy days to come and testify. At this time, I would like to move on to the amendments and welcome Representative Downey back. Representative Nelson.
Madam Chair, I'd like to offer the A3 amendment.
Representative Nelson offers the A3 amendment to your amendment.
And basically what this amendment does is if we're, you know, I don't support the parts of the bill where we're going to be doing increased contracting out, because in my past when I did work for a time in the public sector, we always could provide the work cheaper because we didn't have an overhead. But if we're going to go down this path and we're going to be freezing the state workers' employees, I think to share the pain, that freeze should also be extended to the people that provide services for the state through contract. So that's what the amendment does, that would limit their, just like what they were doing, freezing the state employees' wages and benefits and total salaries, this would do the same thing.
Okay.
And I'd like to ask for a roll call.
Okay, roll call has been requested. There will be a roll call. Representative Downey, would you like to make a quick comment on the amendment?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I'd urge members to oppose the A3 amendment, and I think maybe a more constructive amendment, and perhaps Representative Nelson and I could even work on this, would be some language around the hourly rates or the compensation for the individuals that the state is contracting with. Those of you who've done state contracting know that very typically contracts may have some kind of an hourly billing schedule or some kind of an annual rate for the contractor. Oftentimes they're fixed bid, where the costs that the contractor incurs are at the contractor's risk. So this kind of provision here, telling the contractors what they have to do in their organization behind the contract, I don't think makes sense if there were perhaps some interest in making sure that we didn't have any increases in hourly wage rates over the course of this year or something like that relative to the contracts that the state is issuing. Maybe that's something we could talk about, but this is telling people how to do their business and has no impact at all on the cost to the state.
Any discussion to the amendment? Seeing none, clerk will take the roll.
Chair Pepin?
No.
Representative Murray?
No.
Representative Nelson?
Yes.
Representative Beard?
Nay.
Representative Green?
Yes.
Representative Hancock?
Nay.
Representative Hornstein?
Yes.
Representative McFarlane?
Nay.
Representative O'Driscoll?
Nay.
Representative Quam?
No.
Representative Sanders?
No.
Representative Scalzi?
Yes.
Representative Simon?
Yes.
Representative Erdahl? Representative Winkler?
Yes.
There being six ayes and eight nays, the motion does not prevail and the amendment is not adopted. I have in front of me an A4 amendment.
Madam Chair, I'd like to offer the A4 amendment also.
Representative Nelson moves the A4 amendment to your amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Downing, the A4 amendment goes after the, I know that the counties and the cities have been taken out of this, but currently we in law require counties to report the wages of their top three or the salaries of their top three employees. But this is go down that same level as that we should be requiring these companies that are, if we're going to be replacing public workers with outside contracts, and as was stated here earlier, once we go down that road and we get rid of our state employees, we are then at the mercy of these outside contractors, what they're going to charge us. We should be able to know what the salaries of these companies are and what they're charging their people so that we know if we're getting a fair value for our dollars. And I request a roll call.
Roll call has been requested. There will be a roll call. Representative Downey to the amendment.
Madam Chair, I'm really intrigued by this one, and I'm going to ask members if they would today to vote no and commit Representative Nelson to working with you on this. I know some of what you're getting at, I think, isn't too inconsistent with federal procurement guidelines, and I know there's a whole series of disclosures that are required in state-level contracts as well, and this could possibly be a very reasonable thing to include. So I'm suggesting a no vote here today and committing to Representative Nelson to kind of look at the background of this and work with our procurement folks and make sure that we could do this and maybe have this as an amendment as the bill moves on.
Any discussion on the A4 amendment? Seeing no discussion, the clerk will take the roll.
Chair Pepin?
No.
Representative Murray?
No.
Representative Nelson?
Yes.
Representative Beard?
Nay.
Representative Green?
Yes.
Representative Hancock?
Nay.
Representative Hornstein?
Yes.
Representative O'Driscoll?
No.
Representative McFarlane?
No.
Representative Quam?
Quam.
Yes.
Yes. Representative Sanders?
No.
Representative Scalzi?
Yes.
Representative Simon?
Yes.
Representative Erdahl?
No.
Representative Winkler?
Yes.
There being seven ayes and eight nays, the motion does not prevail and the amendment is not adopted. To the bill, do you have any short closing comments? I would still like to, if members are okay, like to take up the Downey bill. I know he's been waiting the Mahoney bill. He's been waiting very patiently. If members are open to staying for perhaps just a few minutes past committee again.
Okay. Madam Chair, I request a roll call on the vote.
A roll call has been requested. There will be a roll call. Do you want to wrap up, Representative Downey?
Madam Chair, I did have one final comment, and I think it's important for me after the testimony that came about PELRA and all these other things that I don't think certainly aren't the intent of the bill. And I want members to know my father was a public school teacher, One of my grandfathers worked for the Minnesota Highway Department. The other drove a bakery truck in St. Paul and was part of a local. My wife's father worked for the DNR. My wife's mother was a preschool teacher. I come from a family that has a long tradition of public service and public employment. And I want everyone to be clear that what we're voting on today is a bill that attempts to equip the state government workforce with a new set of tools and a new employment model that allows them to become the powerhouse that I know they already are and that we can accentuate with the provisions in this bill. So I'd encourage a yes vote and a yes vote in favor of the capability and competency of our public employees being fully brought to bear to the challenges we have.
Thank you. And Representative Beard just wanted to acknowledge something that was passed out.
I did, Madam Chair. And Representative Downey, I know it's not protocol to speak after the author has spoken. I apologize for that. I was trying to get the Chair's attention. Members, I'm responsible for the blue book that's in front of you. It's from our friends at the Minnesota Government Engineering Council, and they just wanted us to know. The head of that council actually lives in the district I represent. They wanted you to know that they're ready and willing to come and talk about ways to make Minnesota government, at least the government that they perform for us, as effective and as efficient as possible as we move forward. Thank you for the indulgence, Madam Chair.
Okay. Representative Beard renews his motion that House Bill 192 be recommended to pass as amended and be re-referred to state government finance. Is there any final discussion or questions? Clerk will take the roll.
Chair Pepin.
Aye.
Representative Murray.
Aye.
Representative Nelson.
No.
Representative Beard.
Aye.
Representative Green.
No.
Representative Hancock.
Aye.
Representative Hornstein.
No.
Representative McFarland.
Aye.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Aye.
Representative Quam.
Aye.
Representative Sanders.
Aye.
Representative Scalzi.
Aye.
Representative.
No, sorry.
No changing.
We're just following Sanders.
Representative Simon.
No.
Been called a good leader.
Representative Erdahl.
Aye.
Representative Winkler.
No.
There being 9 ayes and 6 nays, the motion does prevail. The bill is a House File 192 is recommended to pass as amended and be referred to State Government Finance. Thank you. To the people in the audience, we are doing one more bill quickly. So to the extent you're leaving, if you could be very quiet and take your conversations outside in respect to the author of the next bill, I'd greatly appreciate it.
Madam Chair, could I get the pages to hand this out?
Absolutely.
Madam Chair, I can do this two ways. I can explain the bill, or I can just say that this is a great bill. Vote for it.
Well, we may need a little bit more than that. Right. First, we need to get the bill in front of us.
Yep.
Does someone have a motion?
Madam Chair, I'll move House File 102 to be passed and moved to Jobs Committee.
Representative Nelson moves that the House File 102 be recommended to pass and move to Jobs.
Thank
Representative
you.
Mahoney,
thank you, Madam Chair,
please explain your bill.
House File 102 is the Science and Technology Authority that lays out the duties and the responsibilities and the cost and how they can spend their money, the taxpayers' money. This is a bill that was in front of this committee last year. What the Science and Technology Authority did last year was set up a group of people to come up with a statewide plan on how we do science-based economic development. We had a group of five. It calls for 5 commissioners because the Constitution requires a state official to expend money, and then it has 19 members as an advisory board. I have been trying to move economic development away from politics and into the realm of how we would do business. So the authority had 19 members on its advisory board, 12 of them from the business community, and 7 from government and academia. House File 102, I will go through it by section. First section is just gives the name. Section 2 is the definitions. The one thing that people have asked about is, I will go to page 2, line 25. It talks about the North American Industry Classification System. These are the science-based, technology-based industries in our state. They encompass about 7,000 out of the 160,000 companies in the state. Subdivision, section 3, where am I here? Subdivision 11. Subdivision 11 on 230 talks about the qualified science and technology companies. It pretty much aligns itself with the angel investment tax credit of last year. Subdivision 3, or section 3, I should say, on page 3.4 talks about how the money comes in from revenue to Minnesota management and budget, and how upon warrants issued by the Science and Technology Authority, MMB would issue the checks. Most of the rest of that page, at least down to 3.24, the tax chair has been very clear he wants to see this bill because of those particulars, so I won't truly go over that other than to say that it puts a cap on any dollars that can go to the Science and Technology Authority at $25 million at any one time, any year. Section 4 is the authorized use of what it actually says you can do. And in that which was passed out, front page here, short-term funding priorities, it kind of goes through what they are. And I'll just quickly go Technology Commercialization Fund, and there's a dollar figure next to it. I'll let you read it because I'm trying to keep this short. It will go through four particular areas: Technology Commercialization Fund, Business Entrepreneurial Acceleration Program, Federal Liaison with an SBIR Enhancement Program, Science and Technology Internships. A quick explanation, and I'll start at the bottom, the internships. What we don't ever want to become is a net exporter of our brain power, and this looks to put internships into science-based and technology-based companies. The federal liaison with the SBIR, that is a federal program through a variety of agencies, the defense, NIH, and a variety of other grant-making organizations to small companies with innovative research in trying to bring that product to commercialization. Business Entrepreneurial Acceleration Program. The simplest way to phrase that is we have 6%, we're number 6 in the nation in patents. We're 41st or 42nd in the nation in the number of new companies starting up in the state. We have to get that 42 up to 6, and that entrepreneurship is what we really need. The Technology Commercialization Fund works hand in hand with the Angel Investment Credit and the SBIR to keep these companies moving forward. Many of these small companies start out as friend and family funded, then they get maybe a little funding from an angel investor, but to try to bring it from concept to concept design and to market, that's where this comes in. And if you look on page 4, line 9, it talks about a $250,000 per science and technology research project, and it has $250,000 in there in many different places. These are all matching. You have to match whatever you get. So it's not necessarily you're going to go immediately to $250,000. It might be a $10,000 grant, and you would have to match that with $10,000 in private money or grant foundation money. Oft times, this is like a university professor or a small entrepreneur. We had a pipe fitter 20 years ago that created a tool and turned him into a 40-year-old retiree, and he needed... He and another guy were 40-year-old retirees because the other guy put the money up, the other guy put the idea up. You know, that's what we're trying to do here. Line 4.20 is none of these funds it sets a limit as to how much of these funds can be used for administrative overhead. And I will address the whole agency authority's overhead in a minute. As I try to get through this quickly, Section 6 is the research, development, and support systems. That is the science. On page 5, line 1, talks about small business innovative research grants and small business technology transfer. Simply put, these are, as I spoke earlier, grants from federal agencies or foundations to primarily federal agencies that try to bring these products to market. A good indicator is over the last 10 years, we have, on a shoestring budget of approximately $100,000 a year, managed to bring in $250 million. Similar states of our size, Maryland, Colorado, on reasonable budgets, not shoestring budgets, have managed to bring in 800 plus every over a decade. So their companies are starting, ours are not. Section 7 gets to the innovation and competitive. That's the entrepreneurial part. All of these, and I want to be really, really clear, that if you are having anything to do as a private individual with the science and technology, asking for a grant, asking for help, you have to write it down and present it to the authority. And the authority has to keep it on record so that we know that they're not just cronyism or doing stupid things. We want this to be really focused and pushed forward. Section 8 is, it just, like I said, it just follows the money from revenue over to MMB and then from MMB to the grantee. On page 6, line 18, it starts talking about administrative funds and other such things. One of the members of the committee has come to me and said that they would like to see that in writing in the bill at a limit, whether it's 10, 9, 5. Government doesn't move fast. I have been working with MMB and revenue and deed to try to figure out what would define administrative costs. We're working on that. I will give you my word. When this bill hits the jobs committee, I will have an amendment that limits that, whether it is at 10, 9, 7, 8% of whatever is given to this agency. But at this particular time, I couldn't put together a well-defined what administrative costs were. And there's a variety of things. So I don't want to get too deep into that, but I promise you that I will show the chair, vice chair, and the member who brought that up, and anybody else who would like to see that. Section 9 is essentially a clawback. If we do something for a company and they move out within 2 years or 3 years, we're going to get that money back, as much of that money as we can back. Section 10 is an expiration date on this whole bill. I agree with people, we should have a sunset date on some of these things. We should really look at them again to make sure that they are hitting their target on return on investment. And many of these states, and I don't want to get too deep into it because of time, but Oklahoma has a $18 to one. We've kept this estimate in the pamphlet that I handed out. We've kept it much closer, like $6 or $8 or $10 to one, because we want to be able to grow and impress people when we come back. So, it's kind of, we'll hold up the Holy Grail when we show what we can really do. I really truly believe that. I will stand for questions. I'm sure there are, because I went through this bill really, really quickly.
Representative Beard.
Thank you, and Representative Mahoney, thank you for coming from the committee. First of all, kudos on the sunset. That's a good deal. It's a good idea today. It may still be a good idea in 5 years, and we can keep it moving along. If it's not, it helps us reprioritize the money here. Just a quick question regarding the funding. You're putting a program in place where we take some taxpayer money to help several things, commercialize research and so on and so forth. How does that fit into or affect the normal angel venture capital stream? Are we going to have a claim on patents or royalties or something from work that may develop because of our intervention or our helping a company move along? Do you follow my question?
I do.
Son of Mahoney.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Beard. That would be a really bad problem. That would be a great problem to have, I'll put it that way. And if you look on page 6, subdivision 1, paragraph 1, this authority has that ability to loan, make grants, and take stock. But it all goes back into the base fund of this agency, of the authority. If we have that problem, it's not been brought up.
So, Madam Chair, as I understand then, Representative Mahoney, the purpose of this, one of the many purposes, is to take nascent technologies or ideas and move them to the stage where they do attract attention from people who would step in with venture capital and so on. So then the fund would just be paid back and we could move on to the next project. Is that kind of what you're thinking?
That is correct, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Representative Beard.
Are there any more questions? Okay. Representative Nelson renews his motion on House File 102 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to Committee on Jobs and Economic Development. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say nay. Bill does pass and recommended to
and members,
Jobs
I would highly recommend, just for your own information, on this website, it's a 5-page executive summary, but it's about a 20-page full report. Very interesting reading.
Thank you. Meeting adjourned.